But my point way back when was, no matter how clever you think you are, you should be careful of Nadashe. You're right, I did work for her family. I know who they are. They will find you where you aren't looking for them. It's what they do. I know that. I know you know it, Kiva. But I need you to feel it. Senia sat up in bed. Look, this might be coming a little early for you because you're, well, you. But the thing is, I'm in love with you. Which is not what I expected to happen. I enjoyed you. And then, after I was shot and you took care of me, I appreciated you. And I've always liked you. But now I know I love you. And that's terrible because now I have to fucking worry about you. So I need you to feel, in your head and in your gut, the idea that Nadashe Nohamapitan is dangerous to you. Because you're not safe until you do, which is awful for me. Kiva lay there in bed, taking in everything Senia was saying. And then, after a respectful pause, she said the only thing she felt she could say in the moment. You're trying to fucking curse me, aren't you? Senia looked confused. What? You're trying to fucking curse me, Kiva repeated. Telling me you love me right before I go and try to fuck with this fucking coup attempt. That's some fucking bullshit right there. Senia gaped at Kiva, then burst out laughing, then collapsed on top of Kiva. You asshole, she said. That's better. It's not better, but it's you. Senia snuggled into Kiva. I'll be careful, Kiva said a couple of minutes later. Okay, good, Senia said. Don't get me wrong. I know you're going to righteously mess up Natasha's plans. No one blows up other people's plans like you. Thank you. You're welcome. Just don't let her do the same to you. I won't, Kiva promised. It was Kiva who set the follow-up meeting, because she both thought it would look better to appear that she didn't trust the conspirators, and also actually did not trust the conspirators. She arranged to have it happen in a public place. The recently renamed Ottavio VI Park. The park was very near Brighton, the late emperor's home in Hubfall, which he had much preferred to the actual imperial palace on Xi'an. Kiva chose the meeting at mid-afternoon when Ottavio VI Park would be filled with people jogging, biking, walking their pets, playing with their kids, and otherwise being in the way. Ottavio VI Park was not grandly sized, but did feature several pedestrian boulevards lined with trees, lush with foliage, forming a near-complete canopy overhead, which would make sniping difficult. Kiva admitted to herself that she was exercising perhaps an overabundance of caution with the sniper thing. On the other hand, Nadashe had tried to murder her with a sniper before, so there was that. Maybe the overabundance of caution was actually a bare fucking minimum of caution when it came to the Nohamapitans. Drusen Wolf was sitting on a bench near the entrance of the park and waved when he saw Kiva. She came over to him. Wordlessly, he held out his hand to her. In his palm was an earpiece, a familiar brand with gesture controls for power and volume on the outside surface. Kiva accepted the earpiece, inserted it into her ear, and tapped it to power it up. 10 seconds later, there was a tone signaling an incoming call. Kiva tapped the earpiece again to accept. Hello, Kiva, Nadashe Nohamapitan said from the other end. Hello, Nadashe, Kiva said. She lightly kicked Wolf, who was still sitting with her shoe. What? He mouthed. Kiva signaled silently that she wanted him to stand up. Wolf looked puzzled. Kiva rolled her eyes, yanked him up off the bench, slipped her arm into the crook of his arm, and started walking him down the pedestrian boulevard so she wouldn't be a literal fucking sitting target. I understand you have an interest in joining our little concern, Nadashe said, while Kiva was hauling Wolf up from his fucking seat. You might understand how I might be concerned about your sincerity. You mean, because I am in control of your house's business, and because your family tried to fucking murder me, so we both have very good reasons to dislike and distrust each other, Kiva said. Yes, that, Nadashe said. Kiva noticed there was a very slight pause between when she stopped talking and Nadashe responded. This suggested that wherever Nadashe currently was, it was not on Hub itself, rather somewhere far enough away that there was just a smidgen of lightspeed lag. Kiva couldn't blame her for that. Nadashe was an escaped criminal, after all. Coming to Hub was asking for trouble. I have already explained to Drusen Wolf my reasons, Kiva said. You can either accept them as sincere or don't. For my part, I'm willing to overlook your family trying to blow my brains out. I understand it was just business. Stupid and foolish as fuck, but just business. And you want me to accept your control of the House of Nahamepeaton as just business, too? It is just business. And right now there's no one else to run it. You're on the run, your mother is in jail, one brother is dead, and the other brother is on end, so he might as well be dead. You'll be happy to know your family business is running along perfectly well at the moment. And when everything is said and done and all accounts are settled, you can have it back. Just like that. Pretty much. Don't get me wrong, Nadashe. The House of Nahamepeaton is paying me handsomely for my stewardship. I'm not running your business out of the goodness of my fucking heart. I'll get mine. But you'll get yours, too. And I'm good enough at running yours that you won't even miss mine.
Getting mine includes those accounts of mine you've frozen.
The ones you haven't already turned in.
Yes. You have to know that sort of transfer is going to ring bells. Explain to me how you're going to get it to me without implicating me or yourself.
Kiva talked at length about how she was going to do that, walking along with Wolf in an erratic pattern. They crossed the length of the boulevard incessantly, moving from tree to tree, avoiding open spots in the canopy and occasionally nearly colliding with bicyclists and pedestrians. If Wolf figured out what Kiva was doing, he gave no sign of it, preferring instead to offer exasperated grunts as Kiva maneuvered him around. Kiva gave not one shit about his aggravation. He was body armor to her at the moment. Eventually, Nadashe seemed satisfied that Kiva could do what she set out to do.
So, we're agreed, Nadashe said. Short term, you get those still hidden funds to me. Long term, my family takes back control of the House of Nahamepeaton.
Yes to the funds, Kiva said. The long-term thing is entirely dependent on whether you can pull off your plans.
Let me worry about that.
I will, Kiva assured her. But part of my deal is being in the inner circle for this. You let me in, and in return, I can tell you, literally up until the last week, the state of thinking from inside the Imperial Palace. And I can help you keep this whole thing silent much better than you've managed so far.
Yes, Nadashe said. I was rather annoyed with Drusen when I found out his moment of gloating led you directly to us. It was unfortunate.
Next time, remind your co-conspirators to keep their fucking mouths shut.
That's a very good idea, Kiva. Thank you, I will.
Now what? Kiva asked.
Now, you've passed the audition, Nadashe said.
Further instructions are coming for both you and Drusen Wolf. You'll know them when you see them.
That's vague.
You won't miss them, I promise. Goodbye, Kiva. I'm looking forward to getting mine, and to you getting yours.
The earpiece went dead. What an asshole, Kiva said to herself. She pulled the earpiece out of her ear canal. By and large, that meeting had gone as well as Kiva had expected it would. She didn't expect Nadashe to welcome her with open arms. That wasn't the point. The point, at the moment, was to build detente and to start gathering information, the better to shove the right sticks into the right gears at the right time. Greyland didn't want her to destroy this coup. She wanted Kiva to grind it to a halt and look helpful as she did it. I can do that, Kiva thought. Senia was right. When it came to blowing up other people's plans, Kiva was the best and was getting better as she went along. And this little adventure was right in line with Kiva's decision, made not long after her first tussle with the House of Wolf, to force change on others for the betterment of all, whether they wanted it or not. This coup attempt was going to fucking fail, and it would be because of Kiva, and when it was done, maybe the interdependency, or at least its people, would be that much closer to being saved. And I'll have punted the fucking Nahamepeatons into the sun, Kiva thought. And, well, that would be a bonus. What did she say? Drusen Wolf asked. You want a transcript of the whole fucking conversation? Kiva asked. She looked down to slip the earpiece into her coat pocket. Just what we're supposed to do next. She said further instructions are coming. I wonder what that means. You tell me. You're the original co-conspirator, Kiva said, looking up just in time to see a hole sprout out of Drusen Wolf's nose above his left nostril. Drusen blinked once, looked at Kiva, and then fell backward. Kiva heard a clatter and turned to see a handgun settling onto the boulevard, people beginning to scream and run, and a person of indeterminate personal attributes lifting a weapon up to her face. Before everything went black, Kiva had time for a final thought. Well, fuck. She really did curse me. Chapter 13. Okay, this gets complicated, Marsh said. He fumbled with his tablet to call up his latest presentation. Cardenia kept herself from giggling at the warning. I know that, she said. Remember what we're doing. Your job is to make what you're about to say comprehensible to people who aren't flow physicists, politicians, journalists, normal humans. Me. You're not normal, Mars pointed out. No, Cardenia allowed. But once upon a time, I almost was. I'm definitely not a flow physicist, however. For the purposes of this presentation, I'll do. The two of them were in the small media theater attached to Cardenia's personal apartments. It could seat about 25 and was where the Emperor, when she felt like letting her hair down, could invite friends to watch the latest entertainments on a large screen with genuinely amazing sound. That was the theory, at least. In reality, by the time Cardenia was done with her daily tasks as Emperor, the last thing she wanted to do was to have a couple dozen people whooping and yelling at something bright and noisy. She mostly just crawled into bed with Mars. And if the two of them watched anything, it would be on one of their tablets, propped up by one of their knees. Mars had once observed the irony of the most powerful person in the known universe consuming media like a starving college student. Cardenia had replied by hauling him out of bed and making him watch their show in the theater. They ended up watching 5 minutes of the show and then did something else entirely, which did not involve watching what was up on the screen. Cardenia smiled at the memory. What they were doing in the theater now was not what they had done then. Okay, Marsh said, and then activated his slideshow on the theater's very large screen. The first slide's title was, What is the Flow? Marsh frowned. You already know this part, he said to Cardenia. Yes, I do, she agreed. Why don't you skip ahead to the new, complicated part? Marsh flipped forward through several additional slides covering the very, very basics of flow physics and the astrography of the flow and the interdependency. Cardenia made a note to have one of her people ask one of the visual artists in the Imperial Information Office to help Mars pretty it up for general consumption. Mars might be a genius in many respects, but visual design wasn't his forte. Right, he said, finally, and stopped at a slide that featured a visual representation of a flow shoal. This is a flow shoal as we typically know it. It's where ships enter or exit the flow, and it's static relative to the most massive object in its system, usually its star. Indeed, in a way, you could say the flow shoal is anchored by gravity. It's why we find shoals in star systems, but almost never outside them. Mars tapped his tablet, and then another representation of a flow shoal appeared, this one moving and shrinking on a loop. But then, about 2 years ago, Mars glanced up at Cardenia, literally just before I got on a ship to come to Hub, in fact. Cardenia smiled at this. A fiver that had unexpectedly been dropped out of a decaying flow stream discovered this, an evanescent flow shoal that, unlike the flow shoals we typically see, both moved independently and shrank. In fact, given how small the time frame in which it existed, it's fair to say that it evaporated. Another slide, filled with equations Cardenia could not hope to follow. How did this happen? I hypothesize that the decay of the flow stream precipitated the existence of several localized evanescent streams that connected temporarily to the main stream, like fibers spinning out of an unraveling rope. There's no gravitational source for them to anchor to, so they don't last. We've never seen this before, because usually when a ship unexpectedly falls out of a flow stream, it's stranded in deep space,
and is never heard from again. There's no data. Tap, new slide. But now that we have that data, and now that, thanks to Hatid Roinold, we understand the concept of and some of the physics behind evanescent streams, I think I have some potentially extraordinary possibilities to consider with respect to how these evanescent streams will appear in local space. Mars stopped. How is it so far? You following? Cardenia held her finger and thumb close together. About this close to not following. Mars nodded and moved to another slide. Then I'll make this simple. I think when an evanescent flow stream appears, its shoal does what our newly doomed fiver saw the disappearing shoal do, but in reverse. It appears, tiny at first, and then moves and grows until it becomes anchored. A pause. Actually, I think all the flow streams do this when they emerge into normal time space, but the regular flow streams have been so stable, well, until recently, that there's just never been a chance to see it there. Maybe leave that part out when you talk to other people, Cardenia suggested. Got it. Mars returned to his slides and advanced another one with more equations on it. So, why does this matter at all? Because if the flow shoals on emerging evanescent streams grow and move, then there may be a way to manipulate and even control that growth and movement, to position the flow shoals closer to human habitats and make them large enough to allow major structures to pass through. So, more ships, Cardenia said. No, Mars said. Another slide appeared, showing a full-sized human habitat, one that could contain hundreds of thousands of people in it. I'm thinking actual places. It took Cardenia a second before it hit her. You want to put entire human habitats into the flow? Want to isn't the phrase I would use, Marsh said, but it might be possible. And if it's possible, then suddenly things get interesting. Interesting, Cardenia exclaimed, because now she got it. If you could stuff actual entire habitats into the flow, then the biggest bottleneck issue humanity had, actually moving millions of people out of systems when starships could transport only a fraction of that number, became much less of a problem. You wouldn't need ships anymore. You could just move people where they lived. And you could save almost everybody. Let's do this, Cardenia said. Mars held up his hands. Hold on, he said. It's not that simple. Why not? Because, well, I don't have a slide for that, actually. Forget the fucking slides, Cardenia said irritably. Just tell me. Wow, Mars said. Cardenia held up a hand. Sorry, that came out a lot nastier than it should have. She pointed up at the screen. But this? It could be it. The answer. Mars smiled. Maybe, he agreed. But there's a lot that has to come before that. Like what? Well, first of all, I have to actually find out if this is correct. Mars waved up at the screen. This is just a hypothesis. It's a guess based on data. And not even a lot of data since it's based substantially on a single event. I'd be a bad scientist if I didn't tell you that this is more than a little bit shaky. Fine, Cardenia said. So how do you find out? I'd need to observe the shoal of an evanescent flow pop into existence. Okay, so do that. And ideally more than one. How many more? Mars wiggled his hands indeterminately. Like, dozens, for starters? How much time would that take? If it was just me, more time than we have. With others, maybe a year. By that time, systems will start being cut off. Yes, Mars agreed. Cardenia frowned at this. But even once we gather the data, all we have is the data. We'll know if the hypothesis is sound enough to become a theory, but then we have certain practical issues to consider. Like how to make one of these shoals large enough, Cardenia said. That's right, and not only that. Mars pointed to the image of the habitat. Habitats aren't ships. They're parked in orbits or at Lagrange points. They don't go anywhere, relatively speaking, and they don't have any way to go anywhere. At best, they have engines that counteract drift, to keep them in their orbital lane, but those aren't going to move the habitats any appreciable distance. We can't get them to a flow shoal. The flow shoal would have to come to them.
And how do we do that?
Mars shrugged apologetically. Well, see, that's the complicated part. So you don't know, Cardenia said, and as she said it, she realized that it came out almost accusingly. She hoped Mars wouldn't pick up on that. He did, of course.
Sorry?
Cardenia counted to 5 before continuing.
No, don't be sorry. I'm just...
Well, I know, Mars said. I'm right there with you. Trust me on that. But I can't work on trying to direct a flow shoal to a certain point without knowing that they move at all. This is the one step at a time kind of science, I'm sorry to say. I hate that there are no shortcuts, Cardenia said. There aren't, Mars said. I mean, unless you can find the data from whoever it is that created the rupture.
What?
The rupture. You know, the thing where the people who were in the interdependency systems before the interdependency decided to cut themselves off from Earth and everyone else.
I know what it is, Cardenia said.
Okay, so whatever it is that they did, they had to understand the physics of the flow extraordinarily well to do it. They actually triggered the collapse of a flow stream, Mars grimaced here, and in doing so, set up the repercussions that we're dealing with now. To do all that, they'd have to know what they were doing better than we know what we're doing. Better than I do, anyway.
So if you had their work, you could bypass all the stuff you were talking about.
I don't know, Mars admitted. I think we need to confirm the moving shoals no matter what. All the rest of it? He shrugged. It depends. But we'd be better off than we are now. But it doesn't exist. You told me GE didn't find it.
Yes, Cardenia said, right.
But what if GE did find it? You mean if GE had all the data we were just talking about?
Yes.
Then I'd be really pissed, Mars said after a moment. Because that would mean that you knew that data existed and that you didn't give it to me, which means I've been burning out my brain trying to save billions of people from dying with the mental equivalent of my hands tied behind my back.
Oh, Cardenia said.
So, does GE have the data from the rupture?
Well, Cardenia said,
Apparently I am history's worst monster, Cardenia said to her father. Statistically speaking, this seems unlikely, Ottavio VI said.
Don't be so sure, Cardenia said. I'm currently on track to fail to save literally billions from a slow death as the universe collapses around them. I'm not sure anyone else compares, statistically speaking.
The universe collapsing around them is not something you can control, Ottavio VI said. Failing to save them is not the same as killing them.
Yes, well, there's some debate about that at the moment.
Cardenia recalled the ending conversation of Mars's presentation run-through, which had, much to Cardenia's dismay, devolved into the couple's first true and actual fight. When it was over, Mars excused himself, ostensibly to continue work on his presentation, but in fact to not have to talk to Cardenia anymore. He had gone to his own quarters in the Imperial Palace, which were basically a dorm-style room for junior Imperial bureaucrats. This is where I'm meant to inquire about the event that precipitated your visit, is it not? Ottavio VI asked. Cardenia narrowed her eyes at her father.
It is, but you're not supposed to say it.
I will remember for next time.
Never mind, Cardenia said.
I don't think you're the person I want to talk to anyway. She dismissed Ottavio VI and called on Gigi to bring forth Raquel I, the first emperor of the interdependency. As Ottavio winked out of existence, Cardenia had the almost plaintive realization that she had dismissed the simulation of her father with the same sort of casualness as she would dismiss any other of the apparitions she encountered here in the memory room. In some very real way, some connection with her father, her actual father, had been lost in the act. Cardenia would have thought on it more, but Raquel I was in front of her, waiting. You lied a lot, Cardenia said to Raquella, a statement rather than a question.
Humans lie a lot, Raquella replied.
Yes, but you lied as a matter of policy, Cardenia countered, during the founding of the interdependency.
I did, Raquella agreed. Whether on balance I lied more or less than other people, or subsequent emperors, is a question that would require some research. If I had to guess, I would say that I was somewhere in the middle of the distribution.
Did lying ever backfire for you?
Personally or as emperor?
Either. Both.
Of course, Raikela said. Telling the truth also backfired for me at times as well, in the times where it might have been kinder, easier, or more politic to lie. Lies do not in themselves lead to poor outcomes, nor does truth in every circumstance lead to good ones. As with so many things, context matters.
It never bothered you to have such a flexible policy about truth and lies, Cardinia asked.
No. I had a specific goal, which was to form the interdependency, and then, once founded, to strengthen it to survive its early years. Truth and lies and everything in between were in service to those goals. The ends justified the means. At the time, I would have said it differently.
What would you have said?
That the end was too important to foreclose any particular means.
That's a convenient bit of sophistry, Cardinia said.
Yes, it was,
Raikela concurred. And once again, Cardinia was reminded that this version of Raikela was not burdened with ego and was therefore not concerned with justifying her actions in any way.
It must be nice, Cardinia thought to herself. Is there a reason you are asking about truth and lies? Raikela asked.
I withheld information from someone, Cardinia said. Data about the rupture that might have been useful to him. He wasn't happy about it at all. He was unhappy that I lied to him about Jihi having information about it and that I wouldn't share it with him.
It's your prerogative, Raikela said.
He's also my boyfriend.
That complicates matters.
Yes, it does.
Have you resolved this?
No, Cardinia said.
I apologized to Mars for lying to him and explained why I didn't tell him about the data. It was because the rupture is the reason we're in the situation we are in now. The choice scientists and politicians made 1,500 years ago in setting off the rupture made the collapse of the flow inevitable. We aren't responsible enough for that data. At least, I don't think we are.
And Mars disagreed.
He said we aren't them, that we're smarter than that. And then I did something I shouldn't have done.
What did you do?
I laughed in his face, Cardinia said.
She looked at Raikela helplessly. I didn't mean to. It just came out.
But he's wrong. Every moment of my reign as emperor has shown me that we aren't better than those people 1,500 years ago.
We're not better than you were when you started the interdependency either.
Sorry. I'm not offended, Raikela said. I don't have the capacity to be offended.
Well, Mars does. And he was. And then he was angry that I wouldn't share the rupture data with him. That I still won't.
You think he will do something terrible with the data?
No, Cardinia shook her head. Not him. I trust Mars. It's everyone else in the universe I worry about.
Once the data is out, the data is out. The people who used it before nearly killed themselves and everyone else with it. They're going to kill us with it as an unintended consequence. We were lucky that information was lost for so long. It's poison.
You don't think Mars could keep that data to himself?
He can't. He's just one person. He can't do all this work himself. If this data turns out to be useful in any way, he'll need to share it with other scientists, to confirm it, and to let them work on sections of the problem while he works on other things. It's what he's already doing. Once they start working with the data, they'll see the implications of it. Nothing stays a secret.
Cardinia smirked as she said this.
You should know this better than anyone. You programmed Jihi to find every secret in the interdependency.
You explained this all?
I did. Mars wasn't convinced. He said that if the data held useful information and I kept it locked away, then if we failed to find a way to save the people of the interdependency, their deaths would be on me.
Cardinia shrugged.
And I'm not sure I can say he's wrong about that. It's entirely possible that I will go down as history's worst monster.
Mars is angry with me for lying to him. He's even more angry about me not giving him the data.
You admitted to him you lied.
It just kind of slipped out.
You probably shouldn't have done that, Raikela said, if you wanted him not to be angry with you.
It's a little late for that now, Cardenia said, annoyed. I was kind of hoping that you might have some experience that would be useful for me to fix this. Because, you know, you were good at lying, and I am evidently really not.
Are you asking what I would do in the same situation?
Raquella asked.
Yes, sure.
I would probably break up with this person.
What?
If there's no personal relationship with this person, then you don't have to worry about him being angry or upset with you. You are the Emperor. You will not have difficulty finding other people to have personal relationships with.
Okay. One, in my experience, that is very not true, Cardenia said. And two, let's assume that, for a moment, I want to actually maintain this relationship.
If you say so.
You'd really just break up with someone like that?
I did break up with someone like that, Raquella said. My first husband. And that didn't bother you? No, he'd been an ass for a while.
Well, Mars isn't an ass, Cardenia said. I'd like to keep him.
Share the data with him.
I already explained why I'm not sharing it.
Share it with him and sequester those he would share the data with.
Sequester, Cardenia said. That sounds suspiciously like put them in science prison so they can't leak.
It would offer second-order issues, Raquella agreed.
I don't think I could do that, Cardenia said, and then stopped. Raquella waited, patiently, because as a simulation, there was no reason for her not to.
Zhiyi, Cardenia called after a moment. The humanoid avatar appeared, standing next to Raquella. I understand that you've tried to access the computer of the Auvergne, the ship that is currently docked in my berth.
Yes,
Zhiyi said.
You've not been successful. Not so far, no.
You're also aware that Tomas Chenever, the artificial person who inhabits the Auvergne's computer, has extended an invitation to you to chat with him.
Yes.
Why didn't you take him up on the offer?
I'm not programmed to accept such an offer, Zhiyi said. I am designed to interact with Emperors in the memory room and to seek out hidden information. Aside from a very limited ability to address maintenance staff for issues I cannot resolve myself, I have no protocols for other interactions.
Cardenia turned her attention to Raquella.
Why not? You programmed Zhiyi. There's no reason not to make it able to deal with other people.
What other people? Raquella asked.
The memory room is designed only to be accessed by sitting emperors.
And no other emperor ever thought to have Zhiyi address anyone else?
Every other emperor accepted what Zhiyi told them about its role.
So I'm just that weird, Cardenia said.
I wouldn't have put it that way, but yes.
Cardenia smiled at this and then addressed Zhiyi.
I would like you to take Tomas Chenever up on his invitation to chat, she said. He's already informed me that he can create a sandbox area within his servers where the two of you can meet. You won't otherwise be able to access his servers, and he won't be able to access yours. It will be neutral ground. Make the arrangements and have your meeting as soon as possible.
Yes, Your Majesty, Zhiyi said, and disappeared. To what end?
Raquella asked.
Mars already shares information with Chenever, Cardenia said, and Chenever has been getting up to speed on flow physics. If I'm satisfied he can be trusted, I can share data about the rupture with Mars on the condition that the only person he shares it with is Chenever. He's an artificial person, and he spent the last 300 years being sequestered. It wouldn't be cruel to keep him cut off from everyone else. He already is.
Cardenia spent a few more moments in the memory room before rounding out her session. Mars was waiting for her when she came out.
I have things I need to tell you, she said. Important things.
They can wait, Mars said. His face was drawn and upset. Cardenia frowned.
What is it?
Something's happened, he said. To Kiva Lagos. Chapter 14. Things were looking up for Nadashe Nohamapitan. To begin with, she'd taken out some trash in the form of Drusen Wolf and Kiva Lagos. But also, and at the moment this was the thing she was luxuriating in, she had a new address. She had been sprung from the dank, fetid confines of the Our Love Couldn't Go On and was now residing on the White Spats and Lots of Dollars, It, like the Hourglove, was an in-system trader craft. Unlike the Hourglove, the White Spats didn't require antibiotics just to look at the thing. The White Spats had been a lease, and now that the lease was up, it had been returned to the House of Wu to be reconditioned before being leased once more. As it was between leases, it was off the roster of ships tracked for commercial use. Proster Wu had flagged it for temporary personal duty, a prerogative of senior House of Wu executives for off-lease ships, and berthed it at the Wu family personal dock complex, where no imperial inspector or assessor would ever trouble it. Unless it moved out of dock, it was effectively invisible. Nadashe was delighted. The White Spats was clean and modern, and the previous leaseholder had configured it to hold passengers as well as cargo, so her living quarters were no longer clad in groaning discolored metal and occasional spots of mold. Proster Wu had populated the ship with a skeleton crew of technicians and domestics, all gleaned from the Countess Nohama Peten's still-in-system fiver, which had been confiscated when she was arrested for treason and murder. Nadashe accepted their fealty as acting head of her house, and then in true Nohama Peten fashion proceeded to forget they existed unless she wanted something specific from them. Living, even temporarily, on the sufferance of the Wu family did have its downsides, however, as Nadashe was reminded when her suite was invaded by Proster Wu, who entered without preamble or indeed so much as a knock. "You murdered Drusen Wolf," he said. "Not I," Nadashe said mildly. She was sitting idly on a chaise longue, flipping through the tablet. "I was here the entire time. I have witnesses." "You cannot go about murdering your allies. That's how they stop being your allies. You need all of your allies. We need them." Nadashe set her tablet down. "Well, Proster, there are two ways of explaining what happened to our dear friend Drusen Wolf. The first is that I did not have him murdered. As it happens, when this is looked into by the various law enforcement sorts who will invariably look into these things, mail will be discovered that reveals Drusen Wolf had lured Kiva Lagos to that park in order to have her assassinated. The two of them had recent contentious business dealings, after all. Bring her out into the park. Have a wandering hitman pop her in the head. We're done. Except for the fact that Wolf is dead." Nadashe shrugged. "A bump. A jostle. This is what you get for hiring cut-rate assassins." "And you expect anyone in the world to believe that?"
"I expect law enforcement to believe it, yes," Nadashe said. "You give them a simple answer, they'll take it every time. It's so much less work. And the simplest answer is usually the correct one. The trail is there. Wolf verifiably ordered a hit on Kiva Lagos. Then he rather unfortunately got in the way."
"I hope his contractor had already gotten paid. Coming back for the second half of his payment would be awkward." Proster Wu did not look in the least impressed. "That's one way of looking at it. You said there was another."
"The other way of looking at it is that Drusen Wolf went out of his way to gloat to Kiva Lagos that she was going to get hers, which inspired her to find out what he was up to, implicating several other houses and me, and you, Proster, in the bargain. Kiva Lagos is the very last person you want to cross, because she's smart and she'll punch you in the throat if you piss her off. And that's exactly what she did to Drusen Wolf. She maneuvered him right where she wanted him and made him jump through her hoops."
Nadashe stretched on her chaise longue.
"She had to go, obviously, but he had to go too, to tie up loose ends and seal off leaks, but also to remind our people that they have to stay focused. There will be time for settling personal scores after the coup, as Emperor. I will encourage all their petty vendettas as reward for their service, but not until after Greyland is gone and I am sitting in the Imperial Palace."
"So you're sending a message."
"I'm not doing anything," Nadashe said. "Like I said, but if any fearful and paranoid allies take a lesson from this and make an extra effort not to do anything stupid between now and when the coup happens, then that's a good thing, isn't it?" She shrugged. "It's a cheap lesson, in any event." The House of Wolf isn't significant to our plans. They're a minor house. And now we have the benefit of Kiva Lagos out of the picture, and the House of Nohama Peaton that much closer to being back in family control, which is going to be simpler for me when the time comes.
So what do you want me to tell our allies? Because they are already howling to me about it.
Tell them whatever you like, but make the point to them that if Drusen Wolf had kept his mouth shut, had not felt the need to crow to someone who uncovered what he was up to as easily as you or I might tie our shoes, he wouldn't be dead right now. That would be the case, no matter which of the two scenarios you believe happened. You might also remind our allies that Drusen's bragging led Kiva Lagos to finding out about their involvement as well. If Kiva hadn't had that falling out with Greyland, Drusen's indiscretion would mean we'd all already be awaiting our treason trials. Nadashe paused. Well, they would. As would you, Proster.
I wasn't in any of Lagos's documents, Proster said. Nadashe smiled.
I think it's delightful you think our allies, as you call them, wouldn't sell you out the instant they were caught.
I see your point.
I thought you might.
You think the falling out between Lagos and Greyland was real, then?
No one in our little club is in jail. Greyland's last roundup of traitors doesn't suggest she wastes any time holding them off when she learns about them. And Kiva is an asshole, so I can see anyone getting tired of her quickly.
That's a yes, then.
It's an, I'm not worrying about Kiva Lagos anymore,
Nadashe said. She picked her tablet back up.
I have other things I'm focused on. Our so-called allies should be focusing on other things as well.
Proster picked up that he had been dismissed and left her on her chaise long. In truth, Nadashe had not been so nearly sanguine as she had suggested to Proster about Kiva Lagos. She wasn't convinced Kiva hadn't been trying to play double agent with Drusen Wolf. When Wolf had come to her with the news that Kiva wanted in on their plans, she had nearly pushed him into an airlock and cycled it, fraught as she was with worry and fear. Inwardly, of course, it wouldn't do to let someone like Drusen Wolf know what she was actually thinking. It had taken a couple of days to have her people deliver the documents that suggested it was as Kiva had represented it. Greyland had gotten tired of dealing with Kiva's ass and found a way to push her out. This delighted Nadashe, because she had come to loathe Kiva Lagos. She respected Kiva, and she worked hard not to underestimate her. And she was well aware that although Kiva was a formidable opponent, as the all-too-large number of frozen supposedly hidden financial accounts made clear, she could also be a formidable ally, with inside knowledge of the Imperial household to boot. But at the end of the day, Nadashe just couldn't take Kiva. Her confidence, her vulgarity, her outer layer of complete anarchy, masking a weirdly inflexible inner layer of morality. Also, the fact that Kiva had banged her brother Granny senseless in college made Nadashe feel queasy, although Granny was never the most discerning person in terms of partners. Nadashe and Kiva would never be allies. It was a shame, Nadashe thought. When Drusen Wolf had revealed his gaffe and Kiva's attempt to capitalize on it, Nadashe didn't waste more than a second thinking about his fate. He was going to have to die, and the sooner the better. But in spite of everything, Nadashe had to think about what to do with Kiva. For as much as she loathed her, and had no doubt that Kiva felt the same about Nadashe, it seemed almost a waste to give her the same fate as Drusen Wolf. Wolf would not be missed for even the amount of time it took him to hit the ground. Kiva would, for at least slightly longer. Still, Nadashe couldn't have Kiva out in the world being a chaos agent just by dint of existing. Kiva had to be removed from the playing board. Nadashe removed her and thought herself wise to do so. Not for the first time, Nadashe wondered in an abstract way if there was something not quite right about her. If one were to list out her deeds over the last several years, one would suggest they were the acts of a sociopath. She had, after all, helped foment a civil war, attempted to assassinate the Emperor not once but twice, the second time killing her own brother as collateral damage.
participated in a coup and was fomenting another one, and in the last few weeks, taken out a small handful of nobility. On paper, these were not the deeds of a nice or moral person. Nadashe did not worry about being nice. Nice was for other people, the people who didn't have power or a plan to get it when they didn't have it. Nadashe could never recall being nice in the generic sense of the term. Polite? Certainly. Respectful when appropriate or necessary. Nice? No. Nice felt like an abdication, like an admission of defeat, like someone who was a supplicant rather than a superior or, at least, a peer. Maybe if you were nice, you would have been married to an emperor already and all this would have been unnecessary, a voice inside her head said to her. A voice that sounded almost exactly like her mother. Nadashe had been the intended fiancé of Renarid Wu, Crown Prince of the Interdependency, until she wasn't, because it turned out that Renarid didn't want a partner so much as he wanted a compliant doormat. A nice, compliant doormat. Nadashe was willing to deal with a lot to be the imperial consort, but not that. And so, here we were. And maybe her mother didn't like that, but then she had killed Renarid by sabotaging his race car and then tried to depose the current emperor. So maybe she wasn't the best person to lecture anyone on nice. So, nice was not in Nadashe's personal vocabulary, but moral was. Nadashe was aware that killing people and fomenting coups were not the usual hallmarks of a moral person, at least not in isolation. But Nadashe believed strongly that there was a context for her acts. The first was the context of the Nohama-Petan family, which was objectively a superior line, not in some ridiculous eugenic way, but in the consistent influence and importance of the family and its house going back to the earliest days of the interdependency, when the Nohama-Petans were one of the first families to align themselves with the Wus. The Wus, and the imperial line in particular, had lost their way more than once. Indeed, that was the problem with the current emperor, who, if not for an accident, well, accident, would be at best a middle-tier academic in some distant system, well away from the halls of power. It was why Proster Wu agreed to sit Nadashe on the throne. He knew it was time for someone to be there who had the courage to do the hard things, and that there was no one in the Wu family, him not excepted, ready to step up for that. As part of the bargain, Nadashe had promised to marry a Wu and to have her heir bear that family name when everything settled and there was a new empire based in the End System. And who knows, Nadashe thought, she might even do that. Beyond the Nohama-Petan family itself, there was the matter of the interdependency and what it really was. Greyland, who had lived her entire life outside of the nobility and the guilds, thought the interdependency was its people, all of its people, a multicellular thing with billions of indispensable cells, none of which would survive without all of the others. This was ridiculous and also futile. There was no way to save every single cell in this vast organism, and it was a waste of time to try. Someone had to be willing to sacrifice the body to save what was important, the brain and heart of the interdependency, the nobility and their monopolies, and the guilds that had sprung up to service both. That the interdependency existed at all is because the Wus and the Nohama-Petans and other noble families had made it so. As long as they existed, the idea of the interdependency and the structure of it would survive and in time would thrive in its new home on End. That was what was important. Nadashe understood, again mostly abstractly, that the billions of people who would die with the collapse of the flow would not be impressed with her reasoning and with her determination to focus on the nobility, guilds, and capital. But the fact of the matter was, they were going to die anyway. There was no way to save them all. There was no way to save even more than the tiniest fraction of them. Nadashe didn't see the point in wasting time worrying about them. The nobles were a vastly smaller number of people to contend with. They understood the value of saving themselves. They were the ones who had the majority of capital. they also understood the real politic issues they were confronting, which was that the vast majority of people in the interdependency were going to die, but that the nobles didn't have to, as long as they were willing to pay the Nohamapetans for access to end. It was simply the cost of doing business in the new paradigm. And in doing so, they would save the interdependency. Nadashe would save the interdependency. In the end, that was the highest morality. And if, on the way there, Nadashe herself had to do some questionable things, well, that was also the cost of doing business in the new paradigm. So, no, Nadashe thought, there was nothing wrong about her at all. She was strong and moral and courageous in a way that history would understand. In a not-at-all-facetious way, Nadashe thought herself not unlike Raquel I, the first emperor of the interdependency. Wash away the myth-making of the Church of the Interdependency and various fawning historians, and you see a woman who had made difficult choices for the good of an entire society. Because those choices had to be made. There would be no interdependency without those choices, and without Raquel I. Nadashe had a fleeting thought that when she became emperor, her imperial name should also be Raquella, to make that connection explicit. She dismissed the idea almost as quickly. It would be a little on the nose, and also, with a new home for the interdependency at end, it made sense not to look into the past. Emperor Nadashe I would do just fine. Yes, indeed, things were looking up for Nadashe Nohamapetan. There was a ping on Nadashe's tablet, signaling that one of her staff was requesting access to her suite. Nadashe let them enter.
The Countess Raphaelia Mason Persaud of the House of Persaud is here to see you, ma'am.
Perfect, Nadashe said. Prepare a tea service, and then bring her in.
Chapter 15. All right, first question, where the fuck am I? The person Kiva Lagos addressed sat at a small desk in a small room and appeared amused. I thought your first question might be, who the fuck am I? All right, fine. Who the fuck are you?
My name is Captain Robinette.
Hello, Captain Robinette. Charmed. Where the fuck am I? Captain Robinette looked over at the two crew members who had accompanied Kiva Lagos to his stateroom. Wait outside, he said. Close the door. If you hear anything other than slightly raised voices, come in and beat her unconscious. The two left. Kiva was unimpressed. You won't make any noise if I fucking strangle you, she said. I'm going to take the chance you'll make noise coming over the desk. And you still haven't answered my question. Where the fuck am I?
Before I answer that, please tell me what you remember before you got here.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Indulge me, please.
Before I woke up here, the last thing I remember is being shot in the fucking face. When I woke up here, I was in a room the size of a fucking broom closet, where I stayed for 4 fucking days with nothing but a case of protein bars and a chemical fucking toilet to keep me company. That thing's a fucking mess, by the way.
After 4 days, it would be. Go on.
Kiva motioned behind her. Then the door to my cell unlatched. And then your pals, Chuckle and Fuckle, told me to come with them. Then I was here. The end. Where the fuck am I?
The amused look on Robinette's face had not noticeably changed since Kiva entered the room, which annoyed her. You're on the freighter Our Love Couldn't Go On, which, as of, Robinette checked his timepiece, 45 minutes ago, has entered the flow stream to the Bremen system, a journey that will take us 15 days and 4 hours, more or less. The previous 4 days were us accelerating toward the flow stream. I was under instruction not to let you out of your stateroom during those 4 days. My employer was quite specific, thus the protein bars and chemical toilet. I assume you figured out there was water in the sink. It tasted like shit. Yes, well, inasmuch as the water is reclaimed, it might. It's potable, but just barely. Fuck you. My employer noted that you might be hostile, Robinette observed.
This isn't me hostile, Kiva said. I assume hostile will be you coming over the desk and strangling me. For starters.
Fair enough, Robinette said, agreeably, and then reached into his desk to pull out a handgun, which he then aimed at Kiva, finger lightly on the trigger. This should keep things civil. Fuck you. For certain values of civil, anyway. Why the fuck are we going to Bremen? Because next month is Oktoberfest, and I've never been. I asked a serious question, and I gave you a serious answer. My employer was specific that you were to be escorted out of the end system, but didn't much care where. I suggested the Bremen system because it's a relatively short hop in the flow. The flow streams to and from Hub are predicted to be sound for a few years yet, and because Oktoberfest sounds like fun, it apparently hails all the way back to Earth times. I've never been, so why not? And my employer was fine with it, so here we are. Let me guess who your mysterious fucking employer is. You don't have to guess, Robinette said. It's Nadashi Nohama Peten, the same person who had you shot in the face with stun pellets. How do you feel, by the way? How the fuck do you think I feel? Kiva said. Like I was shot in the fucking face with a bunch of rocks. Robinette nodded. You look terrible, too. All those little pinpricks where the pellets went into your head and neck. Thanks, asshole. The good news is they'll heal pretty quickly. Almost certainly by the time we get to Bremen. And then what? Like I said, Oktoberfest. I mean, what happens to me, you singularly obtuse motherfucker? That hasn't been decided yet. I was told that once we arrive at Bremen, further instructions will come. We are to wait for 2 months. If no additional instructions have come by then, I'm supposed to toss you out an airlock. We have 3. You may pick. I don't understand, Kiva said. Why would she keep me alive just to have me tossed out of a fucking airlock?
You should ask her yourself.
She's rather inconveniently not here at the moment, you fatuous bag of pricks.
Well, if I set down this gun, do you promise not to come over the desk?
I promise nothing.
I'll take my chances. Please note that the gun is keyed to my fingerprint, so even if you grab for it, it won't do you any good.
I could fucking beat you to death with it.
I'll just put it back in the desk then, Robinette said, and did so.
From the same drawer, he produced an envelope, which he handed to Kiva.
It's from my employer. She was specific that I should give it to you once you were released from your captivity.
Kiva started at the envelope. Oh my fucking God, she's gloating in print.
She may be, agreed Robinette. He pointed to the envelope. If you don't mind, once you read that, I'd like to know what she said.
Why do you care?
I'm curious, is all.
She was a passenger on the ship for some months, you know. From when her mother and all those others were arrested for treason to really not all that long ago. I understand she's traded up in terms of accommodations, and I suppose I can't really blame her.
Yeah, this ship is kind of a shithole from what I've seen, Kiva said.
Perhaps.
But with regard to your situation, Lady Kiva, being inside of it is better than being outside of it.
You have a point there, Kiva admitted.
So, Nadashe was not popular on your ship, I take it.
I believe the polite euphemism is she kept to herself.
Then why the fuck are you doing her dirty work?
For the most obvious reason there is, Lady Kiva, she's paying me very well to do it.
I can pay you more than she can, Kiva said.
Perhaps you could, theoretically. But, as a practical matter, you're on this ship without access to any funds whatsoever. While Nadashe Nohama Peten has already paid me half up front, which is, in itself, more than I've made in the last 2 years. So your money, if you had any on you, which you don't, is literally no good here. Sorry. You're making a mistake.
Possibly, but I doubt it. I heard of Nadashe Nohama Peten long before I ever had reason to cross her path. She strikes me as both singularly determined and absolutely the wrong person to get on the bad side of. So I'm going to take her money and stay on her good side, if that's all right with you.
Kiva snorted. Captain Robinette took that as an affirmation and continued. In the meantime, you have 2 choices, Lady Kiva. The first is to choose to behave yourself, which means staying in the areas I tell you to stay in and keeping out of the way of the running of the ship and the responsibilities of the crew. In which case, you will be allowed some freedom of movement and access to a tablet for entertainment. The Our Love isn't a cruise liner, and there's not much to do, and everyone knows why you're here, and they're not going to be inclined to wait on you. But it's better than the alternative.
Which is?
That you cause me trouble, Lady Kiva.
In which case, I lock you back into your broom closet with some protein bars and that chemical toilet, and you can count the rivets on the bulkhead. And if you're especially troublesome, I might have you tossed out an airlock without waiting for permission. Nadashe wouldn't like that, Kiva said. She's not paying you to make decisions.
That's true. It's her money. But it's my fucking ship, Lady Kiva.
Pardon the language. So, which choice will you make?
I'll play nice. That's what I like to hear.
Robinette reached into his desk again and produced a tablet, which he handed to Kiva. That has guest access and includes information about the ship and the services the crew can provide. You have access to the ship's doctor, which I suggest you take advantage of. And if you talk to the purser, we can get you an extra set of clothes. I'll give those to you. Call it a gesture of goodwill.
Thanks, Kiva said sarcastically.
You're welcome, Robinette said, not sarcastically at all. There are two sex workers on board, but they are a value add for the crew, and you don't have any money, so you should maybe skip them.